This hour is brought to you by Cars for Kids.
Sox Machine.
Jim Margulis, co-host of the Sox Machine podcast.
The big picture is that there is finally a direction for this team that is more than patching up spots on the roster, more than being defense first, more than getting through 2024.
The internet's longest running White Sox podcast.
If Kopech is struggling to get through four innings and walking a batter per inning, like, that holds no appeal to anybody. Whereas if he's somebody who can strike out, you know, 15 batters per nine in a relief role, that suddenly has value. Maybe not so much to the White Sox.
Managing editor of SoxMachine.com.
Where is this next core? Where are these waves of sustainable talent the White Sox thought they were building?
Jim Margulis with Bernstein and Holmes on 670 The Score.
We want Machine.
Sox Machine.
You're damn right we want Machine. We want Sox Machine. Jim Margulis joins us now on the Circus Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circus Sports app. A week ago today, we were at Stadium Swim at Circa having a great time.
Now we're not there anymore.
That's all right, but the sun is out in the city. Beautiful, so.
It's still cold. It's too cold for me to sit at a game yet.
I almost wore my I'm cold, obvious shirt, sweatshirt today. But
I need that shirt because that is my way of life.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you mine if you want.
No, I don't steal other people's hoodies.
God bless you for that, because that is an epidemic.
I know.
You know, I had an ex in college that made off with one of my hoodies. It was my softest one. Yeah.
That's
I'm still
point.
Bitter about it.
As
one
you
of my,
14
years.
One of my exes gave me his hoodie, and I was like, you deserve having this back after we broke up. I'm like, it was always better on you anyway. And he's like, nah. I'm like, all right, but I'm not taking other people's hoodies. Nope, I'm going to have my own.
Ray, did you ever have a hoodie stolen by an ex?
I'm thinking about Stud saying that he's holding this 14-year grudge over a hoodie. I know I've had plenty of clothes stolen away, and I don't think twice about it.
Because you're like, hey.
It was a good hoodie.
Thanks for stealing
the stolen hoodie thing is a thing.
That means that they aren't there.
There's a lot of like good
on my person.
TikToks and reels about that very thing about stolen hoodies.
Oh,
it was
yeah,
a polar plunge hoodie. It was great.
My friend Marshall Harris, who you know well, will warn people about stolen hoodie season. Brandon Pope is also a raising awareness stolen hoodie season person.
It's very important to not have your hoodie stolen. Jim Margulis covers the White Sox and runs SoxMachine.com. He's nice enough to join us now. You ever had a hoodie stolen by a beloved, Jim?
I was thinking about it. No, I've had hoodies where people have liked them and like I've given the shirt off my back and said, if you like it so much, get it. I can replace it. And turns out like, oh, they don't make that anymore. So I did not look ahead and took a gamble that a product would still be available and it's not. So I've had my heart broken by my own lack of foresight, I think.
Oh, man, there's a Bulls hoodie. Do you remember the light blue one they did with the red Chicago White Sox script? Man, that hoodie. I wish that I could have gotten my hands on that hoodie.
Yeah, the one that's based on the flag.
It's so good.
I wish the Bulls would do, I mean, they do a great job with their uniforms anyway, but I wish they would do more with the flag-inspired stuff because you could never go wrong with that.
Also,
ever.
The White Sox script Chicago font, not even the old-school Bulls one, but the White Sox one specifically is like one of my favorite fonts.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. I want them to bring back the script C, but, you know, I believe I'm the only one that wants them to bring back the script C.
Wait.
The current script or the 60s? I like the 60s script.
No,
for the White
Sox,
like
the late 80s, early 90s C.
Okay.
I want that back. The red, white, and blue, like script C. I always like that.
Do you have one, Jim, that you really like?
Yeah, I like I'm partial to the 60s, the powder blue one that has the kind of like powder blue backdrop. I think it was the road jerseys then with the white Chicago script across it. And then White Sox is in capital letters, like underneath the underline of Chicago. That's probably my favorite of the scripts. I grew up like that's the first jersey I remember, or the first jersey slash hat I remember having as a kid was the late 80s one. And I always thought it was an E. So that's why I'm not attached to it, because I looked at it like, oh, that's clearly letter E, as I'm getting a basic understanding of cursive. And I was mistaken.
Well, you know what? Logos that don't get the whole point across easily are not good logos. So I feel like you might be right there.
This is a truism. Tim Anderson is back in town, Jim, and we just played a couple minutes of him talking about his time, especially the last couple of years in a White Sox uniform. How do you view how his career as a White Sox ended?
I think it's it's emblematic of a lot of the ways the White Sox rose and fell, like just with him being a very unique talent that maybe you wouldn't advise to everybody. Like the way he got on base was like hitting like mad and not taking pitches. And it worked for him. But like when it comes to the White Sox, they're over aggressive to a fault, and not everybody is as good as going outside the strike zone as he is. So like you couldn't make the entire plane out of him. He had injury problems. The White Sox had injury problems. He had just inefficiencies on both sides of the ball. Like he couldn't steal bases like halfway in the season because his legs started acting up, and then his range kind of shrunk on him in the field. So like you never could count on him being the same player throughout the whole year just based on his body failing him. And we're seeing that with like Yoan Moncada and Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert and such. So when he was fun, he was really fun, just like the White Sox were really fun. But that kind of ended sooner than everybody thought. So here we are. But yeah, it's, I think you can say that about a lot of players, though, just with so many physical flaws of not being able to stay healthy. Like when Yoan Moncada is good, he's fun, but he's not healthy. Luis Robert, same thing. So it's not a uniquely Anderson problem, but he was there the longest. So I think it gets tied into him being maybe the poster boy for just the White Sox fortunes overall.
I will say that when he was successful, and he put together a long enough streak of being successful, he was elite. You're talking about the batting title. You're talking about what he did to be considered an MVP, at least discussionable candidate. I mean, him and Abreu, those 2 years, 3 years, that was not lost on me what they were able to do. I remember when I think it was April of 2019 when he was batting 400, and I said to myself, there's no way this is sustainable. But then you saw it happen. He moved toward that in a way that caused him to be one of the best batters in the American League that year.
Yeah, and it was a growing process for him, and White Sox fans could grow along with him. At times it seemed like, why are they giving him so many at-bats? Or is this another Gordon Beckham case to where like he's a decent middle infielder for pre-ARB and early ARB prices, but eventually he'll run his course. But just through work ethic and trial and error and having a very long runway to get good, he got good, which I think is the kind of reward you seldom see. Like a lot of times it feels like watching baseball players, like 1,000 at bats, you think like, oh, I have the idea of this guy. And oftentimes there are exceptions where they break the mold like Anderson did, but then those exceptions lead to false hope elsewhere. So I think, you know, when you watch a guy like Anderson finally have that breakthrough and, you know, conquer all those struggles and show why it's worth it, I think you really have to savor those stories, because you'll for every Anderson you have, you'll have 10 guys who show glimpses but aren't quite able to close that hole in their game to where they're, maybe a bench bat, or they're an up and down guy, but they're not a fixture the way that Anderson was.
I would agree with that. I also saw a quote from him yesterday that stuck out when he discussed how, quote, it's hard to win when you don't have the right guys to go out and compete and that want to win it. That spoke of the dysfunction we saw. We all knew what we were watching. It was telegraphed. But for him to say that, what comes to mind to you?
Well, Abreu said something similar when he was with Houston and reflecting on his time with the White Sox and whether there were any hard feelings with, the contract the White Sox did or didn't offer him. And he said something like, I don't have the quote in front of me, but something along the lines of some of the guys want to win, or I'm pulling for some of the players that showed the same desire that I had. So it was phrased in a way to where like, oh, so who isn't in that group? And I think Anderson's saying the same thing. So you do have like multiple sources now from players among peers and colleagues calling them out, versus like any kind of, ex post facto, analysis from like, say, the front office saying that they didn't have desire when, they should have been the ones kind of assessing the mix of the players. Actually seeing players criticizing players as well, which I think carries more weight, because it's easy, I think, for the front office to pivot and say, they didn't have what it takes, because then they weren't wrong about the talent. They were wrong about the desire, but it was the players failing for not putting the talent on the field they have. But when players are doing it, and I think players are probably in most cases, the least willing to throw other players under the bus for effort things because they know firsthand what it's like to gut through periods of times where they're playing with less than their best and just trying to get by and figure out something that works in order to deal with a nagging injury. So I think you wouldn't see somebody like Anderson, who had his own nagging injuries and having to play through a bunch of stuff, call out players for a lack of desire if he didn't think there was something fundamentally wrong.
James Fegan wrote for SoxMachine.com about the really good start that Garrett Crochet is on. What did you find interesting about that piece?
Well, he's got a voice. I think that's what jumped out to me with Crochet, is like when you read his paragraphs, you can hear the way he's saying it. It's not robotic. It's thoughtful. And it's, he's giving consideration in his answers and his process and opening up. And on our podcast last night, James is talking about how the Crochet who was trying to figure out a relief role, trying to get through high leverage innings without the 100-mile-per-hour stuff he came into the league with, and having these very high profile pass fail tests in front of him. Now that he's in the rotation, he's had Tommy John surgery, he's had like reasons to mature just within the game, also had reasons to feel more comfortable in his skin because he's maybe doing the thing he wanted to do all along. He's being a lot more candid and open with just how he's going about his business. And, you know, somebody like James is great at mining that information and asking follow-up questions because he has his own interest in it. And you get to really curious corners of a pitcher's delivery, the thought process underneath how he's going about mixing pitches. And so it's fun when that curiosity is paired with a player like Crochet, who's like, yeah, I'll talk about it. There's no magic or any kind of secret sauce that I can't divulge. Like I'm working out as well, and I'm curious about what other pitchers are doing. So he's sharing it because like he enjoys when other players share it with him and their processes. And it's enlightening, especially like when you have so little as a White Sox fan to like hang hopes on, that having a guy like Crochet who's one, successful, and two, seeming like he's having fun with the success and wanting to do even more with it. That's one of the few areas I think that, as long as he's healthy, knock on wood, that should be a reliable source of enlightenment for White Sox fans.
What do you think about his delivery? Because we've seen a very typical Ethan Katz delivery, more so out of right-handers. But to me, his is different. It works and it's cool compared to all the other ones we've seen lately.
Yeah, he has the high leg kick, and you know, he does a couple things that I think were very reliever profile oriented, with like, oh, you can't repeat that for five or six innings at a time, or you know, he's not going to be able to find the release point in the slider. So he's really going to have to be somebody who throws 25 pitches an inning to succeed. And so reliever, bullpen, easy does it. And you know, it's understandable when he comes in the league without a full college year of proof of concept starting. And then, you know, the pandemic happens. And I think, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty with player development all around, to where like, just it's the easiest route for him to be a productive major leaguer is the bullpen. But yeah, I think when you have the White Sox rebuild crumbling and a whole lot of games that are meaningless, quote unquote, for like a big picture of contending, it is an opportunity to say like, Crochet really wants to start. He's doing everything in his power to develop his body and his arsenal for starting. If he wants to do it, let him try. Let him do some on-the-job training, because there aren't, you know, especially with starting, you have five players you need to fill out that spot. So surely Crochet is better than one of those five options to take the ball every fifth or sixth day and see what he does with it. And in Crochet's case, like it is he has some natural physical gifts. He talks about just being so hulking on the mound and just getting his release point closer to the plate than most pitchers, just because he's that tall and his limbs are that long, that his delivery naturally works in his favor, to where like, throwing a leg kick and he's automatically more than hitters are used to handling. So, you know, if his body is able to hold up for 75 plus pitches every 5 days, sure, you know, reward that conviction, explore the studio space to understand just what you might have. And so far, like, you know, when you can have all those at bats or all those innings to cover, and one guy you weren't counting on having those plate appearances or innings covered, does it in above average fashion. That's found money in a certain respect. And the White Sox need as much as possible to like not spend as much time in last place as it seems like they're going to.
Yeah, that leg is like a fulcrum. Like it's a good balance for the rest of the upper body mechanism. Like it works out well for him. I also want to shout out Eric Fetty, mostly because I liked that signing when it happened. Mm-hmm. But it was nice to see him get the win the other day, and also a shot in the arm for people. I know that that's just three wins there for the entire team, but I feel like there might be something that they've hit on there with him.
Yeah, Fetty, like partially I'm partial to KBO signings just because I've been to a KBO game and it's so much fun. The baseball is fun when you walk around South Korea. Like any player who signs with a major league team after reaching a certain level of stardom in the KBO is followed intensely, especially if it's a Korean national, but like even if it's a player who used the KBO to improve and speaks fondly of his time in the league, like there's a lot of goodwill towards that player. And you see a lot of merchandise, a lot of jerseys, et cetera, with that player because like they're proud of him. So I've always wanted the White Sox to explore that market because it's just fun internationally to see the kind of just cultures of baseball collide and seeing that the brand and awareness expand. So there's that. But also, like, he did use the KBO to become a different pitcher and to work on his arsenal. It wasn't working in the States, and it was a proving ground for him, kind of like Crochet is using this as a proving ground. Like the KBO, a little less talent there, a little less like home run threat with every at bat, to where like you can make more mistakes and you can use pitches you didn't use before and improve them. And he went from being kind of like a sinker slider to having like sinker, sweeper, split change that he works on. So he has three different pitches to go through a lineup two times. Right now, it seems like the third time through is a little bit of a challenge, but the first innings I think are easy enough to where he goes a pretty reliable five so far. And, you know, it's worth giving him those opportunities to improve as well, because it's kind of like the KBO all over again in a way, to where like he has to find out how his stuff works against the best hitters in the world, and he should be allowed to fail. He's older than a typical prospect, but he gets that same leeway just the same because he's proved a certain amount of talent already.
I want to ask you about Andrew Vaughn for a second. I feel like in watching him, this is just the eye test, that at first base he's gotten pretty good. I don't understand why he's struggling at the plate. I was hoping you could shed some light on it. Because, look, I was never high on Vaughn, but I thought that he would be at least a good hitter. Why is he turned into a bad hitter?
That's a question everybody's grappling with, and I guess I can introduce my leading theory, which, you know, is when you look back at the scouting reports and just see how universal the acclaim for Vaughn was, like, it feels like a lot of people are grappling with the same question. Like, why didn't it work? Why does he not draw walks anymore? Why does he not hit for the power we thought? And when it comes to like the White Sox, because I think there are more hitters than Vaughn that this applies to, but the White Sox really prioritized all fields power. Like, you know, Roberts, Jimenez, Vaughn's another one where we don't want him to necessarily sell out for lifting and pulling the ball in the air. We want to be able to hit the ball out to all fields. And it makes a certain amount of sense for guaranteed right field because the ball can carry out to right. Like, you see a lot of cheap lefty homers that way. The White Sox don't have the kind of lefty hitters to take advantage of that. So maybe it makes sense to have some right-handed hitters who can do the same. But I think with Vaughn, whether it's a case of like, you know, because he's on the shorter side versus somebody like Jimenez, I wonder like if it's a case where if they're throwing him away, 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 and he's seeing a lot of sliders away, 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 and he's got to go to right field, being on the shorter side, does he have the natural leverage to hit the ball out to right with authority on a regular basis to where he can, you know, maybe sneak five or six homers over the right field wall over the course of the season to kind of pad his numbers, or, you know, tuck in doubles in the right field corner, because just putting the barrel on it, even without like the full force of your swing, is enough to get extra bases that way. Like, I wonder if it's a matter of just him not ever establishing the outside corner enough to know like which fringe pitches to chase or which fringe pitches to lay off of, or if it's a matter of like he's making decent enough swing decisions. He just doesn't have like necessarily the levers to create the kind of force he needs to hit the ball with authority that way. So the all fields power he showed at Cal isn't translating to the way that the White Sox thought in the upper levels. But again, like when you look at the way he was developed and, you know, how he didn't face double A pitching or triple A pitching, like, is this something that would have been known earlier on, and the White Sox might have been able to adjust faster or trade him faster if they didn't trust it? But because he's been learning on the fly and so much has been thrown in his plate, it's taken years to understand like what his natural limitations are versus throwing him in the deep end and just saying like, oh, you know, it's understandable he's thrashing. So that's, I think, a question maybe the White Sox could have answered sooner had they had the typical runway of double A and triple A, even if he didn't spend all that long there.
Jim, as always, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for having like positive questions to talk about. It was a nice, refreshing change of pace.
What a difference one win can make.
Well, we had to spend 5 minutes on hoodies, though, to get you there. So it's good. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
That is Jim Margulis of Sox Machine. And now you can't see anything that's next to Sox Machine without actually like saying Ice Machine.
It's so true. Yeah, like when Stud saw the Ice Machine at Circa.
Every time I walked by it.
Ice machine. Automatic teller machine. Joe Ostrowski is going to join us. He's going to let you know what you need to know as far as betting into tonight's play-in game.
What about the draft?
Joe's got an extensive notebook on things in draft.
What about draft?
And there's been some movement in who's going to be the number two pick. And it's made people kind of lift an eyebrow. We also need to talk with Joe about the Jonte Porter stuff.
Draft coverage
on The Score is presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of Chicago Bears. I love hearing Dan Hampton on those Chevy Drive Chicago reads. That's my guy. We'll be back after this on The Score.
You're listening to Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2 on 670 The Score.
I have a daily sports betting show.
We couldn't live without Joe Ostrowski.
Oh, yeah. He's got a lot of Herbert Hoover in him. I got to tell you that much.
We are definitely going to ask Joe a question about the draft. And draft coverage on The Score is presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com. And the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado's, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Joe Ostrowski is great. He does all sorts of awesome stuff on the BetQL network. And occasionally here on The Score, which is nice. Hey, Joseph.
What's going on, guys?
There's a lot, seemingly. Yeah. Going on. Why don't we start?
Some things are bad and some things are good and some things are compelling.
Yeah. Why don't we start with Jonte Porter? And
the bad.
Now that you've read everything that's gone into it and seen how the NBA has reacted, what do you think is interesting about all of this?
I'm going to look at it from the sports betting perspective. The first thing that jumps out to me from what I do is that the system works. We don't like what's happening. This is going to continue to happen because you have some people that are not very smart that that will risk winning $20,000, risking their entire careers. And that's what Porter did here. A guy that, you know, what he already make over $2 million playing. We found this out because of the sports books. That's something that should be remembered. And I know some people have taken the viewpoint, well, see what happens when you're in bed with the sports books. Yeah, but there are also rules in place. And the signs are all over the locker room. They're told again and again. Like, how many times do we have to go through a Calvin Ridley, a Porter, the Alabama baseball coach? I think it's going to keep happening. People think they can get away with it, but you're caught up. We had a bookmaker on the other day on BetQL Daily, and it's interesting. He said when they get bettors that they realize are professional athletes, you know, they're probably a little too careful, but they have to be. That first thing they do, they find out, okay, this is an NBA player. Yes, he's in a legal state. He can bet with us. But what they do is they remove all of the NBA and college basketball betting options from their app. that's kind of how this got caught up. And boy, I'm sorry, but you thought you were going to get away with an $80,000 same game parlay betting Jonte Porter unders to win over $1 million and nobody was going to find out? Like, how dumb do you think people are? But I guess we're going to continue to go through this, and Silver did the right thing as far as I'm concerned, because I don't know what Porter was thinking here.
Well, when you put it that way, I do think that there is an appropriate question about whether or not he should have been banned for life. Mm-hmm. Players are asking that. We've heard, I believe Charles Barkley asked that question too. So I want to ask it because I think there is a discussion there that could be had just in discussing the severity of the punishment.
It's arguably an over-the-top measure, because everywhere you look when he's playing games or used to play games, there are advertisements for sports books. I understand that. But like Jonte, you can bet on stuff. And he apparently was. And I don't know if he's someone who has some sort of a betting problem or not, but that's okay. You can bet on other stuff. You can't bet on the NBA. Oh, by the way, he bet on his team to lose when he wasn't playing too. There's that. He was also, Layla, why I think this one's different is he was also trying to game the system. He was betting through an associate. He was sharing information, which they are told again and again that you can't do. Porter didn't get in trouble for betting legally. Porter got in trouble for loading up on unders, which is what he was trying to do. So when you're betting against your own team, like that crosses a different line. When you're giving out injury information, which you're not supposed to do, that's touchy. I think that's an interesting conversation. So if you're dealing with an injury and you're listed as questionable, are you not allowed to talk with your close friends and family about how you're feeling right then and there? Like, how far do they want to go with this? It opens up discussion on a lot of different things, but I don't want to stray too far from Porter being dead, dead wrong in this situation.
It also illustrates the nature of prop bets and how there is a pushback from a lot of people in various leagues and college as well about the risk of them to players in examples like this. What do you think?
Yeah, that was one of my takeaways, that I wonder if prop betting is going to be around. It has become very, very popular. It's something that I do once in a while, but I know people are into it. So I end up talking a lot about it on my show and just different angles that you can go there. But with legalization, every state has a different rule with the colleges in state. Some allow prop betting, some do not. And I wonder if we get there. And also there's another level to this that players are dealing with. Not so much if you're betting on a team to cover the spread or not, or go over or under the total points, whatever sport you're talking about. Just the harassment that they're dealing with online, and these players live online. That's a real thing. Yeah, they're idiots that are doing it, but it happens. And if you remove the player prop aspect, I don't know that it happens as much.
Joe has been probably the most helpful person in guiding me when it comes to sports betting overall.
He told you to fade the White Sox?
I think I figured that one out on my own.
Everyone do that.
Yeah. One, yes. But one of the things that Joe always talks about is that betting the draft could be very profitable because it's about information and not luck. What's going on with the number two pick? Because there's been some weird line movement on who the number two selection in this year's draft is going to be.
I will add, Lawrence, that they are making it more difficult to make money. Big surprise. The books have a few years where they get their teeth kicked in by bettors, and then all of a sudden they're being very careful. They're waiting longer and longer before they post some of these odds. But a lot of betting is out there, and we all know what's happening at number one. So the conversation has been, okay, does the draft really start at two? And there was a time a couple of weeks ago where it was looking, okay, maybe it's after that. Maybe we know what's going to happen, quarterbacks in some order in the top three, and it keeps changing. So it was trending Daniels, Daniels, Daniels. And then over the last 24 hours, there's been a big shift over to Drake May. When you look at a lot of the reputable mock drafts, people that have a history of doing pretty good at this, the stuff that's been released over the last couple of days is more May, and it really seems to be split down the middle. And there's more confusion than we've had throughout this entire process. And I know a lot of it's misinformation. Games are being played. But, man, people really don't seem to know what's going to happen at number two. Is it going to be Daniels? Is it going to be May with the Commanders? We know they're taking a quarterback. We're just not sure which one. I know a lot of bettors in recent weeks as it's been trending Daniels and the number's been getting higher, which means better payout on May. They've been betting May, and it really is split down the middle. That's big, guys. The other thing is, it's not quite consensus, but it's trending this way. J.J. McCarthy is going to be a top five pick. That's where the betting is going right now. He is a minus 175 favorite to be a top five pick. The big question, which team is going to trade up, make that big move into four or into the five slot to take McCarthy? But yeah, quarterbacks, the number one story, it's not about Caleb at one. It's about the others and where they're going to go.
And then quickly, Joe, we don't have a lot of time left, but just notables about the Bulls and Heat play-in game tonight.
Yeah, the line is the Heat favored by 2.5, which is interesting. After the Butler news, that went down to 1.5. Now we're back at 2.5. So some money coming in on Miami. 206.5 is the total there. Coaching advantage, playoff experience advantage. You obviously want to go to the Miami side, which I understand. So I guess that's why the point spread has ticked up a little bit. First thing that I was looking at yesterday was Tyler Hero made threes. That's getting bet a ton to a point where it's so juiced up. I don't know if you want to bet that. I was surprised. I thought there would be some Kobe White overreaction, and the point total for him is 20.5. He hit that number a few times against Miami this season. So I certainly don't mind that. For Bam, not as tough of a matchup as he saw the other night against Embiid. So he could have a pretty decent night on the season. Miami 13-9 straight up without Butler. So could the Bulls march on and continue their run? Yeah, they absolutely can, but we know what's waiting on them on the other side. Unfortunately, the big story with the NBA playoffs, it's injuries everywhere. Whether we're talking about Zion, are we going to see Giannis? What's happening with Kawhi? So it's very confusing on how to do some of the series and futures betting.
Joe, as always, we appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Joe.
That is Joe Ostrowski. He is terrific. Don't Be That Guy is coming up with Layla Rahimi.
The difference this time is you're probably familiar with what happened.
That's next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com in Odyssey Station.
Hi. Caitlin, Greg Doyle, Indy Star. Real quick, let me do this.
You like that?
I like that you're here. I like that you're here.
I do that at my family after every game, so.
Okay, well, let's start doing it to me and we'll be able to get along just fine. So, the question is.
And that is the premise for this very special edition of Don't Be That Guy. I know it was discussed yesterday here on the airwaves of The Score, but there's a reason women in the media, especially in the sports media circles, are so off put by this. First of all, any time that there is an implication of an exchange of affection for result, you have crossed the line into sexual harassment. Let's just call that what that is. When you're asking to have affection in exchange for some sort of result in your job process, yeah, that's what that is. I don't know how they teach it everywhere else, but all of my yearly continuing education classes at my employer, that is the implication there. Additionally, The objectification of athletes, whether they are male or female, is not okay to me. The objectification of people is typically not okay to me at all. But in this blatant of a case, when this is the introductory press conference, and you think that you are going to put somebody in their place in that way, even if you thought that it was being nice in doing so or being complimentary, speaks a lot to how he feels about athletes in general. I always think to myself, we are here because of them. Our job is to ask questions and, yes, have a journalistic curiosity that can also be uniquely our own. But it's to get messages out to fans and people who consume their product. Without them, we don't have our jobs. And the disrespect there to me is just pretty outrageous, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've been going back over it. Let me ask you a question. If he did the gesture, and then she said, oh, you like that, and he said, man, I think it's a really cool way for you to connect with people.
Right. Acknowledged her process.
Everything's fine, right?
Everything is fine. Or tell me more about that. Right. How does it? And
how did you develop that?
I'm not one of those people that says you shouldn't start a question with talk about or ask the question, how did that feel? I actually think that sometimes you do just want somebody to talk about something and you do just want to know how something felt. But when it came to this, start doing that to me and we'll get along just fine.
Yeah, that's like...
How did that not give everybody else some sort of shudder? And you did hear uncomfortable laughter. What made it way worse was the, quote, apology, end quote, where he clearly made it about himself, did not acknowledge her position at all, did not show any empathy. And that is when I want to remind you all this. Negative attention is still a reward to narcissists.
Our guy, David Haw, said this on the way out, and I think that he was right. And David's got a really good compass for, like, journalism, capital J. The idea that it would, the apology itself is monetized, that you did this apology and it also allows for you to gain from it. What I would have wished would happen, you know, apologies are, I'm big into apologies. Like, if it's sincere, it's part of the reason that I love Ted Lasso is because I feel like that show was a guide on what an apology is. An apology isn't, I'm sorry you were offended. An apology is, I did blank. I'm sorry that I did blank. I will try hard to not do blank ever again. And I think on the Ted Lasso show, they do a great job of this. What I wish Greg would have done is take some time. And I get that, like, you're being bombarded. You did something really creepy, and you're being bombarded by people online, so you feel like you have to respond immediately.
You use somebody, and you get to reap the benefits. But yes, you do probably have to actually acknowledge your behavior.
I'm okay with the acknowledgement as long as there is some reflection. And the reflection didn't feel...
The reflection had to do with his own.
It felt rushed. Like... Take some time to kind of understand what it is that you did. Because he had to apologize twice because his first apology didn't work.
And the thing is, if you're listening to this show, and if you're a regular listener to this show, then you've probably either had empathy enough to hear somebody and cringe respectively in a scenario like this, or you've heard people tell you about times where they felt objectified or had something creepy like that happen to them. Like that's the thing. Like on Twitch, I know the Twitch stream is filled with people who I find are very empathetic. Like if you're listening to this show, you've either had that situation happen to you or somebody's probably told you about it because you get it. You know, you're a willing listener of this program. So I give us the benefit of the doubt there.
Could you imagine what the react would have been if roles were reversed?
That's it, man. Like, fired.
Right?
Fired.
Immediately.
I remember there was an interview done by a morning show reporter. I think it was a morning show reporter in St. Louis with David Freese after he, it was after the unfortunate for me.
The World
Series. Great for them, 2011 World Series. And she was hitting on him, and at first it was like her just trying to be cute, and at the time I think it was more accepted, but it was uncomfortable. That's uncomfortable. I don't care who you are. And I said male or female. I say everyone, male, female, non-binary, like anybody in that position. I don't want to exclude anybody there. There's objectification that goes on with all. And to me, when you have that implication of the affection in exchange for treatment, tell me how it's not that. But what I thought was very savvy were all the people replying with the copy and paste of the article because they didn't want to give
right.
credit to the author at all.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's he's going to gain from that experience. And I was like, wow, like that is not right.
It
at
just
all.
Made me shudder.
It made anyone who's normal had a like, ooh.
I can't wait though to read the great Candace Buckner's Washington Post article about this, because not only does she illustrate this, but she also, I think, fairly calls out the discussion surrounding it in a way that is intelligent and hurt, because the summary is, my thoughts on Greg Doyle, righteous indignation and the insincerity of outrage. And I know she says that coming from not just an intellectual place, but one that's well-reasoned, and I would like to hear what she has to say. So I want to look forward to reading that. But either way, this is a friendly reminder that negative attention toward a narcissist is still a reward.
When we come back,
don't be that guy.
Don't be that guy. When we come back, we will preview the Bulls play-in game. Cody Westerlin is going to join us to tell us everything that we need to know about Bulls Heat. That's next. Bernstein and Holmes, Lawrence and Layla, until Cubs baseball at 12:45 on The Score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.